All right. Now, I have been teaching for the last few classes about the Kabbalistic explanations and descriptions for how God manifests itself into our world. And of course there's a duality here. There's the spiritual divine world, and then in which God resides, and in fact is not a place at all. That's a misdescription. For God is beyond place, beyond time. And then there is our world, the world that I call the world of forms and names, the world that is the phenomenal world, the temporal spatial world, the world of time, space, and matter, the world of our universe, the world of our planet, the earth, and the world of all the animals and the human beings. And that is the lower world. And the divine worlds are the upper worlds. There are several of those. And those are more states of divine consciousness, divine being. Just as this world is a state of divine consciousness, but a much grosser, less subtle, more coarse level of consciousness and being. For all being finds its source in the essential one being of God. Nothing exists outside of God. God is all. God is in all. But this world that we live in did not always exist, and thus we have what the Bible refers to as the creation. And of course, it is a creation. It's a creation that came as a result of a desire that came about in the transcendent, unknowable, ineffable, inexperienceable God that has no name, who is beyond all words, beyond all thought, beyond all desires, beyond all experience of mankind, but which God has been given for as point of reference by the Kabbalists, the name Ein Sof. Two words, E-I-N or A-Y-N, depending on how you transliterate the Hebrew into English, and Sof. S-O-F, Ein Sof, which literally means without end, without end. Sometimes referred to by the Kabbalists as the eternal or the endless. But we shall refer to this transcendent God as Ein Sof in the actual Hebrew words, Ein Sof. Okay, this is the God that cannot be experienced by any human being ever. This is the God that is beyond the physical universe. And this is why we say this is God in his transcendent form. But at one point, God came to desire, a desire arose within God, to manifest itself in a physical form. And so God did so through a series of 10 stages of manifestation, which are depicted in the Kabbalistic Etz Chaim, which means Tree of Life, which is a diagram which is used for teaching and contemplative and meditational purposes by Kabbalists, in which there are 10 circles connected by 22 lines. And perhaps you have seen this. If you haven't seen it, you can go to our website, and on the front page, on the right-hand side, is a diagram of the Etz Chaim, the Tree of Life. It's called the Tree of Life because it is the stages by which God's will became manifest in the world, and through which the world, the stages through which the world was created. It's equivalent to the 10 utterances. The 10 utterances being given in the first chapter of Bereshit, which in English is known as Genesis, the book of Genesis, the first book of the Torah. that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. There were 10 utterances by which the world and everything in it was created. And these are easily recognized in the English translations because they generally start out with, "And God said, let there be light." And God said, let there be a firmament between the heaven and the earth. And God said, and it goes on and on. And there's 10 of these utterances. And so these 10 utterances are represented and symbolized in the diagram of the Etz Chaim by the 10 sephirot. The word for each one of these is sephira, which etymologists and philologists, linguists, dispute the origins of in Hebrew. And it's translated variously as jewels, based on the word sephira being similarly close to sapphire, even in the Hebrew, and also on numbers. And in the decimal system, of course, there's 10 numbers, and then everything repeats. You have 1 through 9, and then 10 is the 10th number. It's starting over. Or 1 through 9 with 0 as another digit. And so each one of these sephirot represent the 10 numbers in the decimal system of numbering. The 22 lines between each of the 10 sephirot, overall, there's one line between going from each of the sephirot to many of the other sephirot. They don't all interconnect, but there's 22 lines. These are representative or symbolized symbols of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, which is regarded by Judaism as the divine tongue, the holy tongue, the divine language. It is the language that God used to create the world. First, there was the desire to create. Then there was the will to create. And that's representative of a thought. So we have desire, and then we have thought. And then there was the divine speech, whereby in the first chapter of Genesis, God says, "Let there be light. Let there be this. Let there be that." And it is only through the transformation of desire into will or thought, and from there into utterance or divine speech, that the world comes into existence. Now then, I have been speaking about this for some time, and what I've been speaking about is most recently is about the two types of existence that there are, that there's really out of, even though we've got 10 numbers, there's really only two numbers, 1 and 0, existence and non-existence. And of course, in this computer, this digital age, it's easy for us now to understand and relate to that because the binary number system is what's the basis for all digital communications. And it's the basis for computers. And it's the most simple number system of any that we have, the base 2 number system, 1 and 0s, 1s and 0s. Every number can be represented by a series of 1s and 0s. Well, the reason this is the most primary base numbering system is because it represents the two conditions of reality, existence and non-existence. You and I right now exist, but we're not always going to exist. But while we exist, we can say that we have a condition represented by the number 1. When we pass, before we were born, our existence could be described by the number 0. And when we pass away, our existence can be represented again by the number 0. Okay, so it's everything in the world, not just life, but even the universe itself and all of the elements in it, the stars, the planets, they all have a lifespan. which means that they did not exist at one point, came into existence, endure for a short period of time in relation to God, which is eternal, and then pass out of existence, cease to exist. So everything that is created can be described by a number sequence, 010. God can be described by two alternative number sequences, 0, meaning that time and existence, that existence is the only attribute that applies to him, that he's the essential being. And philosophers, if you look at metaphysicians and they discuss the concept of being, they will use terms to describe these two conditions as essential being versus conditional being. And so I'm going to get into that before I get into the other thing I just started on. Okay, so there's essential being and non-essential or conditional being. Everything that is created is conditional being. It is non-essential. By non-essential, I don't mean that it... Well, I guess I do mean that it's necessary. Because we have to look to what essential being is. Essential being, of course, is God. God is the only essential being. And we say that God is the essential being because its very nature is, or essence, okay, its very nature or essence is existence, is being. There was never a time in which God did not exist, and there will never be a time or condition in which God does not exist. Therefore, God can be described by the verb is. God is infinite in terms of his characteristics and the length of existence. And in fact, characteristics and time of existence do not really apply to God in his purely essential state, in the transcendent state. All other things are created. All things other than God are created. And all created beings can't owe their existence to the Creator, who is God. So all created things are conditional. They exist only because God willed them to exist, and because God set in motion the conditions that would allow their continued existence, and because God has not changed his mind. God has determined right as of this moment that we shall all continue to exist, that the universe shall continue to be, and that all of the rules governing the interactions between all of the parts of this complex web of existence shall continue to hold sway. So the laws of physics still apply. And therefore everything continues on pretty much as it always has, since God brought it into existence at some point, way back when. So these are the two conditions, existence and non-existence, the two numbers at the root of everything, 0 and 1. Now, the reason that I'm teaching you this is because it is the purpose of Kabbalah to do this. In fact, I'm going to read to you a two-sentence statement from a Kabbalistic text written in the 1700s by a great Kabbalist named Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, known by the acronym formed from his initials as the Ramchal. And the book is titled 138 Openings of Wisdom in English. It's titled that. And opening 18, part 1, states, "The entire purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah is to understand the particular root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. Anything that can exist without being dependent on something else must have its own root." Okay, so what he is saying is what philosophers since that time have all come to echo. And he was saying it back at that time, and back in the 1700s, and of course other philosophers were too. He was not a philosopher. He was Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was a Kabbalist, but he was making a philosophical statement. But what's important about this statement is that he's saying that it's the entire purpose of the wisdom of Kabbalah to understand the particular root of each of the different phenomena we find in the world. So we can go and we can look at anything in the world. We can look at any of the physical laws. We can look at any of the physical manifestations, any of the planets, the galaxies, or if we want to go down onto the lower level, go down into and look through the microscope at all of the tiny microscopic microbes and bacteria that exist. All of these things, he is telling us, can be understood by understanding, but these phenomena can be understood by understanding the particular root of them. And he goes on to say that anything that can exist without being dependent on something else must have its own root. But what we find out when we begin to examine everything is that at its root, everything that we are capable of examining, which are the contents of this phenomenal world, are all created beings, and therefore do not have their own root. They owe their beginning, their current existence, and their end to the will of the Creator, the will of God. And so the root of everything in this world is God. Now then, we can demonstrate that. It's actually being demonstrated right now with physics. Let's just take a quick look at where modern quantum physics has taken us. During the time of Einstein's sway in physics, the science of physics eschewed any kind of reference to or possibility in the existence of an organizing principle that ontologically caused any of the universe to come into existence. In other words, the idea was that everything happened as a result of probability, pure chance. That the world exists in its current, I'm going to say it's easier to understand this in terms of the universe. The universe came about and has its current form as a result of an almost infinite number of links in a chain of cause and effect. And that's all the more. In other words, the world is totally, there's no master design. There's no blueprint that caused the universe to exist in the form that it exists right now. However, Einstein spent almost all his theory of relativity, which is accepted and has not been disproved. It's not disproved at all. It's been, if anything, it's been proved, his theory of general and specific relativity. But that came early on in his career, in his late 20s, early 30s. And we've all seen pictures of him as an old man with the wild white hair. He lived to be a quite old man. What did he do? Did he just retire from physics? No. He spent most of his career searching for the unifying field theory, the grand theory that would unify the fields of general and specific relativity, which is really a theory of gravity, with the field of electromagnetism, electromagnetic theory, and there was one other one. The quantum physics field of the weak atomic field. This is the field that studies the forces that hold together the particles inside the atom. So we know that we have these fields, and he was seeking an overriding or root theory. So here we have a physicist who's doing what the 17th century, or excuse me, the 16th or 18th century Kabbalah said, searching for the root cause of phenomena in our universe. So here we have Einstein doing that, but he was never able to find that root theory and that unifying field theory, and so he was very disappointed about that, considered that to be a great disappointment in his career and life. But he kept it up until he died, but it was just not successful. However, in the 1980s and the 1990s especially, the field of quantum physics exploded. And what happened was, of course, we split the atom in the 1940s when the Manhattan Project, and of course the very first practical use put to that scientific knowledge was to bomb into oblivion two Japanese cities, and I'm not saying that perhaps it didn't save more lives than it cost, but it's just so fitting that humankind, the first use it makes of anything it discovers is to make a weapon, a bigger, more powerful weapon out of it. But science went on, and because of our atomic and nuclear research, we built nuclear accelerators and nuclear colliders, bigger and more powerful ones, and we started breaking down the atom into its component parts. And I remember when I was in high school, which was in the early 60s, we were taught the Bohr theory of atoms, and basically what they were is like a miniature solar system. You had a nucleus, which was equivalent to the sun, and then you had all of these electrons, which were orbiting like the planets around the sun. And of course, we now know that that's a gross oversimplification. But what's interesting about this is the farther we go down in expanding what was formerly invisible to us, the more we find out that things that we thought were solid are really, there's less and less that's solid in them, and more that's just vacant space. In other words, you've got all these electrons orbiting around a nucleus, and so what makes it appear to be a solid is not the particles, but the electromagnetic force that holds them in those orbits and doesn't allow other electrons that make up the atoms and molecules of other things solid, like our fingers, to penetrate them. So I can't, like this desk that I'm tapping my knuckles on right now, I can't penetrate that desk, even though it's almost all made up of space, because of the electromagnetic fields that hold those atoms and molecules together. Okay, now I've made the point I want to make, I'll move on. Quantum theory, as we've gone on, has revealed that there are more and more particles. Every time if you take an electron, you find out that the electron is really not a particle, but it's a bunch of other particles in a swarm. And that those particles are made up, like there's psions, pions, and mesons, and I don't know how many there are. I think it's dozens now, well over a dozen particles that they've discovered. And they've discovered some very interesting facts about these things. One of the things they've discovered is that they have now demonstrated, proven scientifically, that some particles don't behave according to the laws of physics as we knew them before. In other words, they pop in and out of existence. That a cause or let me put it this way, a stimulus in one place can be felt across the universe instantaneously in another place. And they've demonstrated this scientifically. And so they're having to come up with more with theories that go off of the standard orthodox chart of physics, and they've come up with what's known as string theory. And under these theories, the universe consists not of particles, but particles are made up of tiny, very, very tiny strings of energy, little pieces of energy, some of which are a string, like a piece of spaghetti, and others of which are connected at each end, so that they form an ever-changing, vibrating, not a circle at all, but like a non-geometric, constantly moving ovoid. And it's through the interactions of these strings that particles come into existence in our universe. Now, where do they go if they're not in this universe? Or where do they go when they pop out of existence? Well, they theorized the existence of several parallel universes that exist in parallel planes. And it's like there's a curtain between these universes. And these particles have the ability, some of them, to cross over between, through that pane, to tunnel through that pane, pop out of ours into the other one, pop out of the other one and into ours. And it started out that they thought there were three of these in the 80s. Then it went up to five, then six, then 11, and now the smart thinking is saying there's an infinite number of universes. What's more, this infinite number of universes is such that it's influenced by thought, that there's absolutely nothing that you or I can think without, upon the moment of its thinking, of our thinking it, that it fails to come into existence or already exist in one of these universes. So, just as a thought experiment, right now, try to think of something that you've never thought of before. And if you're successful, it's very hard to do. Very, very hard to do. But if there's anything that you are capable of thinking of and bringing it into your mind, then instantaneously, if it did not already exist, if not in this universe, then in another of these infinite number of universes, the fact that you thought of it extends a creative force into the existence of the universe that brings about the existence, the reality of that thought somewhere in one of these parallel universes. Now that's pretty scary. A pretty scary and awesome thought. But it's not just physicists who think that way. This is the teaching of Kabbalah. Centuries and centuries ago, the Baal Shem Tov taught on this. Baal Shem Tov was a Kabbalist who lived in the 18th century, in early 1700s in what's now known as the Ukraine, which at that time I think was a part of the Lithuanian-Poland Commonwealth. And he lived in a tiny village in the Ukraine. And he was a Kabbalistic master, and all kinds of miracles are attributed to him. But he teaches us that a man awakes with fervor, ready to create. And you know what? This is so important that I'm going to find that exact quote. It'll only take me a few minutes, so please bear with me as I go to a place where I've kept some of his quotes written down. It'll take just a moment, so please bear with me. I have to go through a whole bunch of directories here. Just a second. Come on. Come on up. Kabbalah. Working files. Okay, let me find the sayings of the Baal Shem Tov. Selected sayings of the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov, by the way, means in Hebrew, master of the good name. Okay. Here's what he says. He says, referring to a human being, to a man or a woman who wakes from sleep, from a good night's rest. Quote, he takes unto himself the quality of fervor. He arises from sleep with fervor, for he is hallowed and become another man and is worthy to create and is become like the Holy One, blessed be he, when he created his world. Well, so each of us awakes with fervor and energy. And the reason is we have been hallowed in our sleep. We have been sanctified in our sleep. We've been renewed. And as he says here, and become another man. And we can apply these things beyond gender. This is not specific to men or women. It's to humankind. And become another person worthy to create. And in fact, has become like the Holy One, blessed be he, when he created his world. What does that mean? Who's the Holy One, blessed be he? The Holy One, blessed be he, is the immanent God who's manifest in this world. That's the God to whom we direct prayer. We don't direct prayer to Ein Sof, because Ein Sof has no personality. Ein Sof is beyond personality. Ein Sof doesn't hear, neither hears nor cares about our prayers. But who does is that manifestation of Ein Sof in this world of forms and names. And that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. That's Yod Heh Vov Heh, symbolized on the Sephirotic tree, the tree of life that I mentioned to you earlier, as the sixth Sephira, named Teferet. Teferet Yisrael, beauty of Israel. Okay, so it says here, the Baal Shem Tov, this great Kabbalistic master, says that after we sleep at night, during that sleep, God has restored us and hallowed us and made us a new person, worthy to create and to become, and not just create in a general sense of, yeah, we're going to go out and do good things for God and for our fellow neighbors and people and like that, but even more so than that. We have become like the Holy One, blessed be He, when He created His world. Well, what was His world? What is the world that the God Most High, Yod Heh Vov Heh, the God of the Bible, the Old Testament, created? That's this world. So He has made us like God, fit to create new worlds. And indeed, we are taught by Kabbalah that we can and do create new worlds when we pray to God, when we recite His holy names, when we love God, when we do ma'asim tovim, good deeds in the world. We then create new worlds. Where are these new worlds? These are the worlds that are in the universe, in the stars right now, even in our own universe, there are galaxies still forming. There are new stars being condensed out of gas clouds. And planets are condensing out of the material that doesn't fall into the stars. And so solar systems are being created. And outside of our galaxy, there's a billion other galaxies in our universe that are estimated by astronomers and astrophysicists, and beyond that are an infinite number of other universes, some of which might contain stars, some of which contain other forms of existence, because there is nothing limiting God's creativity. All of this has been created, because Ein Sof, who did not exist physically, decided that he would create the concept, first of all, of physicality, and then place himself in it. And so God is in all of these universes. God is in all things in the universe. Baruch Hashem. This concludes today's teaching. I will continue on. And Olive Tree, please don't leave right away. I'd like to talk with you if I can after this class is over. At any rate, we'll continue on this in our next teaching session, our next year class, which will be on Monday at the same time and place. This class has been recorded and will be rebroadcast tonight in the same room at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time. And until we meet again, I wish you well, only the best. I ask that you remember God at least twice, without whom you and I would not exist and this world would not exist. And so remember God twice and have mercy upon the land and your animal friends and your neighbor. So until we see each other again, be well, go from strength to strength, and Zeigesund.